Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, Dr. Matthew Jebb introduces us to the May tree.
The hawthorn trees are in full bloom up and down the country, and traditionally, this is the tree that signifies the beginning of the summer months. A frost after the May tree has come out is incredibly unusual. So we can sort of rest comfortable now that the summer season is well underway, and the smell and the scale of the blossom of the hawthorn is a striking sight in every little roadway up and down the country.
We discover why some plant species are dominated by bumblebees, while others are dominated by honeybees.
So my name is Francis Ratniex. I'm Professor of Apiculture at the University of Sussex in southern England. So I study bees, and this particular project is on foraging of honeybees and bumblebees, and why it is that some flowers have mostly honeybees on them, and other species mostly bumblebees.
And whatever about Gene Kelly singing back in the day, all last week, outside my front door, it was a case of a blackbird singing in the rain.
Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on, sing along.
No, okay, we won't. Anyway, good evening. Very welcome to the programme. And what a busy show we have ahead of us today. Now, who would care about the rain when you've got that beautiful blackbird singing in the background? And I'm sure I'm not the only one to notice the blackbird was singing during and after the rain. What is it about singing in the rain? What's it all about? Anyway, we'll ask our panel. We'll start by saying hello to Richard Collins and Malahide and Niall Hatch and Grey Stones. Richard, it's been raining quite a lot all over the country this week. I'm sure you got a downpour in Malahide too. Was it welcomed?
Yes, Derek, and it is most welcome. The ground here has been rock hard now for a very long time, and the rain has come, and it takes a while to have effect because it's so hard, the ground, that the rain runs off it and escapes. But it's softening up fast, and the birds absolutely love it.
Oh, they would love it. Sure, they're able to get all the larvae and everything else.
Absolutely, they're having a ball.
Niall Hatch in Greystones. Niall, so I was playing there just a little clip of the blackbird that's been singing, sometimes on my roof, sometimes on my neighbour's roof, but always in the rain. The rain doesn't seem to affect the blackbird. And if you go to our website, rte.ie/Mooney, you'll see the worst photograph ever taken by anybody on the planet, by me, of this blackbird singing in the rain, because I took it with my phone. It was quite a distance away. But it was the only bird I noticed during the rainstorms, but it was piping away there at the very top of the roof.
Yes, blackbirds are well known for this. They're often associated with the rain or often singing just after the rain as well. And very few birds do this. And this is probably the secret and the reason why they do it, because they have the airways to themselves. When it's a nice sunny day, all the birds are singing. So they're competing to some degree with the song thrushes and with the robins and with the blackcaps and the blue tits and the wrens and all of these birds. And they do a good job of it and they have a good strong voice. But when it's raining, most of those other birds stop. And that means that the blackbird has this uninterrupted clear air that it can sing in, which will mean that its song will carry even further. It'll be more noticeable. It'll stand out more to potential rivals and to potential mates. And so that's the theory behind it as well. And of course, blackbirds, they are birds that do like the rain because it does soften up the ground. It makes it much easier for them to find worms. They can get through there when it's prolonged warm weather without any rain. What happens is, as Richard was saying, the ground gets very hard. And of course, blackbirds can't get down and get the worms they need for their chicks. It's harder, though, for birds that are mainly insect eaters, particularly birds like swallows and swifts that rely on flying insects, because when it's raining for a prolonged period, their chicks can actually starve because it's so hard for them to find food. So it swings and roundabouts. Some birds benefit and some don't, but the blackbird certainly is a bird that does like the rain.
Is there a danger of the feathers getting destroyed by all the water, Niall?
Feathers are the most remarkable things. They are wonderfully waterproof. They have these barbules on them that zip together and repel raindrops. And it used to be thought that this was because the birds put a special oil on their feathers that would naturally repel the water. But it seems that that oil they put on from this preen gland they have on their lower back, just near their tail, it seems that that actually just is more like hair conditioner, really. It conditions their feathers to keep them in good condition and makes them zip together properly. And it's the actual structure of the feather itself that repels the water. So that blackbird's skin is not getting wet. That water is just going off it like water off a duck's back or off a blackbird's back. It's the same process. It's obviously different for its chicks in the nest. They'll want to be well sheltered. So mum blackbird may well be sitting on the chicks or the eggs to make sure that they don't get chilled because they don't have the same level of protection. But the male himself, his job is to do the singing and to defend the territory. So he'll be nice and visible. He can go right out in the rain. And provided there isn't too much wind that might ruffle his feathers and cause the water to penetrate them, he'll be absolutely fine. He'll be dry as a bone.
Actually, one of the nicest things I ever saw in my life, and I mean this sincerely, is when we put a camera on the jackdaw's nest back in the year 2000. And the jackdaw had built its nest, Richard, you'll remember, in a chimney. And it started to rain one day. And the female who was kind of keeping the chicks warm because they had already hatched out and regulating their body temperature had opened her wings like an umbrella and put the wings over to keep the birds dry. It was extraordinary to see it.
I remember that, Derek. It was quite an observation to see that in the flesh, having read about it and all that, actually to see it was wonderful. I think there's an element of time management about your blackbird. A bird, or any creature really, has to divide up its time as intelligently as possible. And everything's a trade-off. Time singing is time you can't spend feeding. So if you want to be big, fat and strong, you should feed a lot. If you want to impress ladies and things, you should also sing a lot. But the two contradict each other a bit. Now, in the rain, I suspect the bird says, well, I can feed great after this. The soil will be wet. The worms will come up because the worms will feel the patter of the drops on the surface and they will come up to the surface knowing it's wet up there and they'll be able to get at the detritus. So I suspect there is something like that going on. It can defer feeding because it knows the rain will bring the worms up.
Yes, time management is very important for the birds, especially at this time of year when they have so many hungry mouths to feed. Blackbirds particularly, they're run ragged by their chicks because they have a very interesting breeding strategy. They almost always have two broods, at least here in Ireland. And what happens is that the female obviously will lay the eggs and then the parents will both feed those chicks when they've hatched out. But then when it comes time for those chicks to fledge, which means to leave the nest, dad will look after the first brood while the mother then is incubating the second lot of eggs. So at the moment, a lot of people will be seeing male blackbirds around feeding their chicks. They're wondering where the females are. They seem to have disappeared. They might think that their bad mother is not looking after their chicks. They're already getting ready for the next lot to come along in the next few days or weeks. So it's a very busy time for them. And at the end of the nesting season, so in the next few weeks, you'll see the blackbirds start to look quite ragged. Their feathers get a bit tattier. And then, of course, they may be more prone to the elements. They won't be so keen to be out in the rain then until they've molted their feathers. And that's why so many birds, particularly songbirds, molt their feathers at the end of the breeding season, because just the wear and tear, the toll it's taken going back and forth all day long to feed those chicks and to look after the eggs as well has really damaged their feathers so much that they need to replace them to make sure that they're nice and waterproof and warm then coming into the autumn and then the cold winter months. That's how they survive.
The really mysterious singer is, of course, a close relative of the blackbird, the missel thrush. Now, this bird is also known as the storm cock, because in storms it sings, I'm told. I've never actually heard it do this because it don't be out in storms very much. But apparently when a storm comes, the storm cock goes high in a tree and sings out into the gale. I suppose there's some element of time management in that, but it is a mysterious thing for a missel thrush to do.
It is, and they're often, as you say, at the very highest point they can find. So in a storm, the top of that tree is whipping around the place. It would seem quite dangerous. And I've heard a theory that the pitch of the missel thrush's song is such that actually the sound of the wind, rather than drowning it out like it would for other birds, it actually helps to carry it further and project it over a wider area, which especially at the start of the breeding season would mean that that male missel thrush, because of course it's just the male that sings, which is the case for most of our birds, it may have a better chance then at attracting in a female from a wider radius around. So that's maybe one of the reasons why they do it. It might also be showing off his skills. It's a lot of bravado involved in this. He's showing, I'm tough, I'm healthy, I'm strong, I can handle this storm. So ladies, I'm a very attractive prospect. I can look after myself very well. I have good strong genes. I'd make a good father for any chicks that we might have together. And I can clearly provide well for them because I'm fit and healthy. My territory has lots of food in it. And this is what's being conveyed through these songs. So I find that absolutely magical. Likewise, Richard, I've never actually witnessed the missel thrushes doing that myself in a really harsh storm. I've seen them singing in rain all right, like the blackbirds, but not when it's really blowing a gale. But I believe they do it. They're quite well known for it.
Well, they may be able to sing, but can they dance like Gene Kelly from Singing in the Rain? I bet they can't, but they should learn. Anyway, let's move on. Niall, you were on Rockabilly last week.
I was. Rockabilly Island was a real treat. I got to spend a few days and a few nights out there at Ireland's most important tern colony. So Rockabilly Island, for those who don't know it, it's a very small island, basically a lump of rock. It's off the coast of Skerries in North County Dublin. It's about 6 kilometres offshore. And you access it, we got there is actually by taking a boat out from Malahide. So from your neck of the woods there, Richard. And it's a wonderful place to be. So at this time of year, it's full of thousands of screaming terns. So terns are migrant seabirds, and there are three species of these that nest on Rockabilly Island. We have the common tern, which, as the name suggests, is the most numerous. There's about 2,000 pairs of those out there. There's a few pairs of Arctic terns as well, maybe 50 or 60 pairs of those, and they're mainly nesting on the smaller island called the Bill. So Rockabilly technically is two islands. It's the Rock, which is the big one, which has a lighthouse on it, and then there's the Bill, which is the smaller island, very hard to reach, and that's where the Arctic terns would live. And then we have the most important species there, the roseate tern. So last year there were 1,600 pairs of that. That's Europe's rarest breeding seabird, and Rockabilly is home to what is by far the largest colony of this species in Europe. It's a very interesting species, the roseate tern. It's very beautiful. It's like the other terns, it's a very pale bodied bird, sort of very pale grey, white below. It has a pinkish flush on its chest, which you see at close range. So on Rockabilly, when they're all around you and they're sitting on the walls beside you, you see that pink flush on the chest very well. You don't often get to see that when they're flying further away from you. They have long tails, long forked tails with streamers on them and long pointed wings, which gave them the old name of sea swallow. That's what they were known as by many sailors for centuries. And like the other terns, they have a black cap on top of their head. And the easiest way to distinguish between the three terns that nest on Rockabilly is by the colour of their bills. So the Arctic tern has an all red beak. The common tern has a red beak with a black tip on it. And the roseate tern at this time of year has an all black beak. And then over the next few weeks, as the breeding season goes on, they'll get a bit more red towards the base of the beak, but it'll always be mostly black, or at least half red, half black, never majority red like the other two. And it's amazing there on Rockabilly Island because my colleague, Dr. Stephen Newton, who's looked after this project there with the support of the National Parks and Wildlife Service for many years, he has done wonders for this bird. It went from virtual extinction in Ireland to a very low number to being now a powerhouse for this species. It's basically a roseate tern factory, and the birds that are raised on this island, they then naturally go and recolonise and repopulate other colonies around Europe, particularly Cocot Island in England, the Skerries Islands that are in Wales, there's islands in Brittany, and also then the Azores. There's interchange between Rockabilly and the Azores, which is another very important colony for this species. So it was amazing to see that work up close and personal and to enjoy the sights and sounds and smells of a seabird colony. And I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And of course, this is a species and a project that has featured on this programme for many years now, and it's important to keep the pressure on, isn't it?
Oh, it is. We can't be complacent. So it's been a big success. It's been running for over 30 years now, run by Birdwatch Ireland and the National Parks and Wildlife Service. But, something could go wrong. We have to be careful with this. You can't have all your eggs in one basket or on one island. We want to make sure now that Rockabilly can be a source of roseate terns that will then populate other colonies around Europe and indeed in Ireland. We're hoping that more of these birds may colonise the Dalkey Islands, for example. They may then extend to some of the islands in Wales, in Brittany, and also more of them going to the Azores. So we're not going to rest on our laurels. We're going to keep pumping out those roseate terns and making sure that the species is secure.
And this is the time of year they're actually breeding. So did you make a little recording for us with Steve Newton when you were there?
Oh, you know me, Derek, always prepared to do that. I'm not going to miss that opportunity. So I did. I had a chance during a quiet moment to sit down, actually just on the jetty, which is the only relatively quiet place on the island where the terns aren't constantly dive bombing you and pecking at your head. And I chatted with him about the project and what's going on this year.
We've been out a couple of days now. We're in the third week of May and we're in the final stages of project setup really. So on Monday this week we brought out 15 new nest boxes and 2 new hides which had been paid for by the Roseate Tern Life project last year. We've had these things prefabricated, they're a bit like IKEA flat pack kits that we have to then assemble on site. And then, very importantly, secure into the rock so they don't get blown away by storms. So we've had a busy couple of days, mostly working on the hides. We've put out a few boxes yesterday. The terns just started laying, so literally 5 days ago we had the first common tern egg, and the following morning we had 2 single roseate tern eggs. So now, 5 days on, it's getting very busy, lots of 1 and 2 eggs and occasionally even a 3 egg common tern nest. So the birds are very busy. I'm sitting on the pier, lovely sunny afternoon, looking over towards the Bill, the second island, and there we have Arctic tern's beginning to get established, so there's lots of courtship and copulation going on, so it's really interesting, and we look forward to seeing where those Arctic terns will eventually nest, on the bill or on the rock. We've probably got a few on both sites. So, exciting time of year. We've got all our boxes and hides up and secured. We've got a big storm forecast for tomorrow, so the wardens are on high alert during the storm. So this year we have Emma Tiernan back for her third year as a Rockerbill warden, and we have two new guys and girls, one Micheál Fitzgerald from Cork and Alexandra Fink from Munich, surprisingly. So we've got an eclectic team here, a Dub, a Cork and a German, and a guy called Steve Carrington, who comes out here. He's my pally handyman, and he helps me with a lot of the woodwork and plumbing work. So we'll be back in a couple of weeks to hopefully do the final nest census.
That was Steve Newton of Birdwatch Ireland on Rockerbill talking with Niall Hatch. Richard.
Niall, the story brings back a memory, an extraordinary memory. Many years ago, I went on a ringing expedition with Hugh Brazier and Mark Avery to Rockerbill. We brought along with us a stuffed stoat. The idea being that we'd get the chicks all right, but we wanted to catch a few of the adults to put rings on them. So we set up mist nets, that's a spider's web type net, in the mallow, the vegetation there, and put the stoat up on top of a wall, thinking in our foolishness that the terns would see this stoat and they would come in their numbers and get caught in the net and we'd ring them. But no, not a single tern was fooled, although it was a perfectly mounted stoat, yet not a single bird went towards it. Now, the other memory is of the tremendous aggression of terns. Terns, it's not like a gull colony. They swoop at you in a gull colony, but they don't usually hit you. They do occasionally. But the tern will come down on the top of your head and he'll draw blood. And they're very aggressive. But interestingly, I want to ask Niall if he agrees with this. There is a kind of symbiosis here. I believe the roseate tern is less aggressive than the Arctic and the common tern. Now, all three nest together, or rather the roseate, I think, like to nest with common and Arctic terns, because they know that if a fox or whatever, a person comes, an intruder comes, they know that the common and Arctic terns will attack. They don't have to then go to war with the aggressor so much. Is there a kind of symbiosis here, a kind of trade-off?
Yes, Richard, that's absolutely right. And that's why it's so important for a thriving roseate tern colony to have a thriving population of these other more aggressive terns, because they do very much depend on this defence mechanism that the other terns provide. So we know at other colonies in Ireland, so a good example would be at the Dalkey Islands in South County Dublin, we want to encourage roseate terns to nest there because we put out nest boxes for them. We know that they're habituated to using these nest boxes that are placed on the ground on Rockerbill. So we're hoping they'll recognise them and will go to Dalkey and nest there as well. But before that can happen, we need to make sure that there's a secure colony there of Arctic and or common terns that will defend those roseate terns. And roseate terns, it seems, won't actually nest in a colony generally, or won't start nesting in a new place unless those other tern species are present. So there is very much this beneficial effect. What seems to happen as well is that the common and the Arctic terns tolerate the roseate terns quite well. They don't seem to come into conflict with each other. They must be competing for some of the same resources in terms of catching fish for their chicks offshore. But I think that perhaps that, you know, more pairs of eyes looking out for danger would be a benefit there. The roseate terns do seem to be very observant. They're often among the first to flush when danger comes, so they'll fly up when they see the predator, or indeed a human warden walking through the colony. They often tend to be a bit flightier, and they may serve as an early warning system, I suppose, for the other terns. And of course at Rockerbill, even though it's quite a remote island, and it luckily doesn't have any mammalian predators, so there are no mink out there, there are no rats, there are no mice, and that's why it's such a thriving seabird colony. We do still get visits from gulls coming across, and we do also get sometimes daily visits from a peregrine falcon that will fly in and take some of the adult birds or some of the young tern chicks later in the season when they're starting to fly. They're easy pickings. But what happens is when you've got this big critical mass of thousands of terns all squawking and dive bombing, they can drive predators away. They will even try to drive away gulls very effectively, and even peregrines. If they spot them coming in, they'll pick this big cloud up in the sky to try and confuse it and whirl all over the place making lots of noise to try and disorient it, and hopefully then the peregrine will give up and just zoom back to the mainland. So it seems quite effective on Rockerbill, I have to say.
Well, good luck to all the wardens who are stationed out on Rockabill for the season. And we hope that more and more roseate terns breed and hopefully, as Niall has said, colonate more parts of our island and further afield right out into Europe to keep this species alive.